I just, during the break, some people were asking about homosexuality. I know it's a complicated and difficult issue, but one that's also very pressing with regards to our culture today. And normally, as a speaker for Stand to Reason, my employer, I'm required to bring product like books and tapes and CDs and DVDs and stuff. But because I was traveling with my family, the four suitcases that I had in the car wouldn't have fit my product bin. So instead, they asked me to bring along just one book, which happened to be my latest book. And it also happens to be in the topic of homosexuality. It's called The Ambassador's Guide to Homosexuality. It was just published, actually, last month. And it's a short book, but it's on specifically homosexuality and how, as ambassadors for Jesus Christ, we can understand and have knowledge of the truth and of the error, like, you know, knowledge, wisdom, character, how to engage in an artful method of communicating that, and also how to have a winsome character when you do so. And so a lot of the things that you were asking about, which is, can we love homosexuals and accept them? And does that mean accepting what they do? Or does it just mean accepting them as people? You know, what causes homosexuality? What leads people to have same-sex attractions? Is it genetic? Is it a brain function? Is it something else? Is it a choice? I answer these questions in this book. And so if you're interested in getting it, I brought, I don't know, not that many because I couldn't fit it, but maybe like 8 or 9, 10 copies. So if you want to get it, that's all I brought because it's all I could fit. But if you're getting it just at the break or something, you can pick one of these up. It's not just, you know, an academic kind of book at all. It's more practical. In fact, at the end, I give different principles for how we can engage homosexuals who are either trying to join a church or being a part of a church, homosexuals who might be our friends, or homosexuals who might be in our family, and what kinds of principles can we employ that are both biblical and effective at being able to maintain relationships with the people and communicate the gospel still. So I try to address all these things, what the Bible says, what science says, as well as practical principles for engagement in all three of these environments. So I encourage you to consider that if you're interested in more about that topic. Okay, so let's jump back in here into tactics. And so we've learned the first tactic, which is the Colombo tactic. This is simply the foundational tactic, which is at its core asking questions instead of statements, either to respond to challenges or to navigate in conversation. And so we want to build upon that another tactic, which, by the way, I believe all of you already know this tactic. You probably just don't realize you do or have never thought about applying it to religious conversations. But I'll prove it in a few minutes that I think all of you already know this tactic. It's called taking the roof off, and it's based on this Latin term, reductio ad absurdum. Does anybody know perhaps what that might mean? That's right, reduced to the absurd. So even if you don't know Latin, you could probably figure that out. And that's precisely what this tactic is about. It's about the fact that many people's views, or in fact, many people's statements, can be reduced to an absurdity. Meaning, if you were to follow the logic of what they're saying, it would lead to something absurd or ridiculous. And as a result, that means you can reject, or they can reject, the logic of their view. Okay? So let me show you first the three steps that you would employ when using this tactic, and then I'll show you how I think you already know this tactic. So here's the first step. The first thing you want to do is adopt the person's viewpoint. So have you ever heard, maybe you've heard yourself or someone say this, well, they say something like, well, just for the sake of argument, let's assume that, you know. What they're doing is they're adopting the person's argument. And so we want to first kind of put ourselves in the position of their view. You want to say, okay, let me just assume that what you're saying is true. Okay. So that's the first thing you do. By the way, in order to understand what their view is, what might you do? Ask them what their view is. And what tactic could we use to find out what their view is, what they believe? The Colombo tactic. Yeah. Hey, what do you mean by that? Tell me more about that. And that will tell you what their view is. So you find out what their view is, and then here's the key. You take their view for a test drive, if you will. You assume their view, and you say, well, what logically follows if I accept what they're saying? You know, what are the consequences of their view. What does it lead to? Does it lead to something that makes sense, or does it lead to an absurdity? And if it leads to an absurdity, their view, then we can reject the rationale that led to their absurdity. Yes? Oh, I'm going to use many examples, yes. So, again, first you adopt their view, and then you ask, well, what follows from their view? What are the consequences of accepting their view? And then the third part is you simply ask a question, and here's the key point, that graciously exposes the absurdity of the view. Now, let me give you an example of how I think that you already know this tactic. Imagine the hypothetical conversation between a father and his daughter. His father, the daughter has just started smoking, and the father's all bummed out about this, so he asks his daughter, "Honey, why did you start smoking?" And she says to him, "Well, Dad, because all my friends were doing it." And what's the father going to say in response? That's right. If all your friends jumped off a cliff, would you do that too? Okay. Now, what the father has just done is he's taken the roof off. He's employed this tactic. So follow this with me for a moment. The daughter has just said, "Well, the reason why I was doing it was because all my friends were doing it." So here's what the father says. Okay, let me, first step, adopt my daughter's viewpoint. Okay, my daughter's saying this. If my friends do it, then I'll do it. That's her rationale. So he says, well, let's take that rationale for a test drive. What would logically follow? What are the consequences of that view? Well, that would mean that if all her friends jumped off a cliff, that would mean she'd jump off a cliff. Well, that's absurd. That's right. And so is the rationale that led to that absurdity. So that's why he says, well, then he asks a question. Well, honey, if all your friends jumped off a cliff, would you do that too? And so she realizes, no, that's absurd. That's right. He just reduced her view to the absurdity. So do you see how that works? That's all that taking the roof off is. And again, you already knew that this was the right question the father should ask his daughter because you were taking her view for a test drive. You were showing that her rationale and her statement leads to an absurdity. You're right. That is an easy one. But, you know, that's how you teach anything. You start off with easy examples, and then you work your way up to more complicated ones. In reality, though, the vast majority of false views are susceptible to this tactic. Because most views that are false lead to absurdities. And so almost 80% or 90% of things that I hear people say that are not true, that are hostile to Christianity, if you take them for a test drive, they'll lead you to some ridiculous, absurd conclusion. So let's take a look at... Oh, let me give you one other example. Jesus actually employs in this form of tactic as well. So in Matthew 12, he's just healed a demon-possessed man. And the Pharisees are all upset about this because, you know, they were always trying to thwart his plans. And listen to what Jesus... Listen to how this conversation transpires. When the Pharisees heard about Jesus healing this demon-possessed man, they said to Jesus, or they said about Jesus, "This man Jesus cast out demons only by Beelzebub, the ruler of the demons." And Jesus, knowing their thoughts, he said to them, "Any kingdom divided against itself is laid waste, and any city or house divided against itself shall not stand. And if it's Satan that's casting out Satan, then he is divided against himself. How then shall his kingdom stand?" So here's what Jesus does. He says, let me adopt first step of the tactic. Let me adopt their viewpoint. Okay? And their viewpoint is that basically I'm Satan and I'm casting out other demons that are basically on my team. Now let's follow that to its logical conclusion. What consequences would result if that was actually the case? Well, let's think about it. Any military that's literally shooting its tanks at one another is going to destroy itself, right? And so could an army or a military survive if it was literally attacking itself? No, of course not. It would be completely overrun and destroyed. Well, the same case is with Satan. If Satan is really casting out other demons and destroying other demons, well, that would mean that the realm of Satan and his war effort would be destroyed and thwarted. But wait a minute. Satan survives just fine, and he's possessing people all left and right. So if it was really me casting out, if I'm Satan and I'm casting out of the demons, then Satan's dominion would be over. But it's not. That's ridiculous. It's not. Because look, it perfectly exists just fine. And so that's how Jesus was showing the Pharisees the ridiculousness of their view. So Jesus came to our website and learned this tactic, and that's how he employed it with the... I'm just kidding. No, it's the principle of logic. It's not something that we invented or anyone invented. It's just the way logic works. And Jesus knew this, and that's why he incorporated this tactic. He accepted their view for the sake of an argument, followed it to its logical conclusion. It led to an absurdity, and that is, it can't be that I'm Satan casting out other demons, because then Satan's dominion would not exist. It would be weak. It would be thwarted. But it's just fine. It's fine and healthy. That's a ridiculous view. So that's why he could reject the rationale. So let's take a look at a couple of kind of more straightforward ones here. All religions are true and equally valid. We've kind of looked at this a couple of different times already. But this is a statement that we can incorporate this tactic. Now, we all know the statement is false. But let's just accept it for a moment. All religions are true and equally valid. Is there anything that, if that statement was true, would lead to something absurd? What consequences might result that would be ridiculous or absurd if that statement was true? Like, what do we know about, let's just say, the beliefs of, just take two religions, Islam and Christianity, and their view of Jesus, for example? What would be true if... What's that? Yeah, what can be? Okay. I totally agree. And why can only one be true and the other not be? What would be contradictory or ridiculous if they were both true? That's right. Christianity teaches that Jesus is divine, the Son of God. He is God. Islam vigorously rejects that. That's like the absolute greatest sin in Islam, to say that Jesus is God. In fact, Muslims believe that Jesus is merely a human being. In fact, only a human being. Yeah. Okay, good question. I'll get to that in just a second. Let me just flesh this out just so everybody's clear. So if all religions are true and equally valid, that would mean that it's true that Jesus is only a human being, and it's also true that Jesus is God. Well, Jesus can't be God and not God at the same time. He's either God or he's not God, you know. The Islam teaches that the Quran is the word of Allah, is the word of God. Christianity says, no, it's not the Quran, it's the Bible, it's the word of God. Well, if this statement is true, that means the Quran is the word of God, and it's not the word of God at the same time. Well, that can't be. That's a contradiction. That's absurd. That's right. Because the rationale that led to that absurdity is also absurd. It's ridiculous. It's false. And so the question that I might ask a person who says this, I'll say, well, you know, that's interesting that you make this claim that all religions are true and equally valid. Well, what do you think about the claim that in Islam they teach that Jesus is not God, and in Christianity they teach that Jesus is God? How can they both be true if they're completely opposite? You know, I would just point out some inconsistency, something that sounds ridiculous that would be true if that statement was true. And it could be anything. And it, you know, you might have to know something about Islam. But let's take another example. Here's something that I've heard Rosie O'Donnell say, amongst many other homosexual activists. They say, look, gay sex has been observed in animals, so being gay is natural and normal. Okay. So what is the rationale? Let's take the first step. The first step is to understand and accept the person's viewpoint just for the sake of argument. And what's the argument, the rationale being offered here first? We should be like animals. Close. What's that? We are like animals, but what are they saying about the morality of the issue pertaining to animal? What's that? It's not a moral issue. it's so gay sex is not a moral issue, and that's right. That's right. So the viewpoint being expressed here is if animals do it, then it's okay and natural and moral. Okay, that's the rationale. So now let's take that rationale and see, does that rationale lead to any absurdities? What possible absurdity might that lead? Yes? Yeah, no, that's a great, you're right, that is a great, well, that's a perfectly great question, and that would be legitimate. Yeah, there's all kinds of things wrong with the statement, okay? I'll grant you that. But just for the sake of practicing this tactic, we're going to try to respond to it using this thing. So, again, the rationale is, if animals do it, it's okay for humans to do it. That's right. They kill each other. That's right. Well, animals kill each other. In fact, some animals kill their own young, right? So that would mean that it's moral for humans to kill their own young or eat their own young. That's absurd. That's right. That's why we call it reductio ad absurdum. So is the rationale that led to that absurdity. Okay? Animals kill each other. Some animals eat their young.
What's not the same?
That's true. It's not the same thing, but the rationale is based on the same exact rationale. No, I understand. Yeah, you're right. I mean, they could say lots of things, but the fact of the matter is that rationale, which is whatever animals do, is normal and moral for humans to do. That rationale is present there, but that rationale also is present in the statement that black widows kill their spouses. Snakes eat their young. We're not going to do, humans can't engage in that because that would be absurd. So again, that's how the taking the roof off tactic works. So let's take a look at a bunch of examples of things that people have said to me, and we'll break up into pairs or threes, and I want you to think of a Columbo question that takes the roof off, okay? That accepts the rationale, follows it to its logical conclusion, and then realizes it leads to an absurdity. By the way, all of these statements lead to absurdities. So all of them will work. But just try to think of a question that might show the absurdity that rationale would lead to. Okay, just pick one or two, and then we'll come back and we'll go through each of them. Any questions, though, about the tactic before we practice this? Okay, let's try it. So just getting twos or threes, try to work through a couple of these, and then we'll come together here in a minute. And if you have a question, just raise your hand. I'll come to you. And if you're stuck. The bottom two ones are difficult. So if you're struggling with the bottom two, pick one of the ones that is above that. But those are the two hard ones. So you're probably thinking, they're all hard, but the bottom two are the hardest. What's that? The last statement? You mean you agree with it? Oh, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Just because even if you think capital punishment is fine, you could still think that the reasoning there is wrong. There might be other reasons why capital punishment is wrong, but that's not one of them. Let's just put it that way. In other words, you don't have to... Yeah, kind of. Yeah. All right, let's try to go through a couple of these here. So maybe just raise your hand and tell me which one you want to try to address, and we'll see if we can take the roof off with some of these. Yeah. Okay. What's the rationale there?
If you're born with an actual tendency, then it's okay.
That's right. That's exactly the rationale. So what possible absurdity might that lead to if you follow it to its logical conclusion? Okay. I was born with a natural tendency to be a pedophile, so that would mean that being a pedophile is okay. Now, that is a perfect example of taking the roof off, but here's the problem with it. Although you perfectly did the tactic, the problem with that example is that it's kind of over the top in terms of grossness, and here's what's going to happen. If you say that in the conversation or the context of homosexuality, what people will assume you're saying is that you think homosexuals are pedophiles. Even though you didn't say that, it doesn't matter. So this is where knowledge, wisdom, character comes in. And where you want to try to use your character to make the conversation more gracious and winsome. And so although that's the perfect example of taking the roof off, you want to use other examples that are less kind of over the top, less crass, and that don't inappropriately communicate that you think homosexuals are all pedophiles, which I know you're not saying that, but it doesn't matter. That's what they'll think you're saying. That's what they'll hear. So can you think of another example of something that you might have a natural tendency to be born with that isn't like that?
Rather than take an example where they might have
Yeah, so you would generalize it. Yeah, yeah, absolutely, you can do that. You'd say, yeah, well, so are you saying that just because you're born with a natural tendency that would make it okay? And so you kind of leave it up to them to think in their own mind what perhaps would be an example. You could do that. Do you want to add something?
The question I would ask that question is how do you identify natural tendency?
Okay, yeah, that's a good... Yeah, so that's like a Columbo, the first application question. Tell me more about it. How do you even know what that looks like? You know, what does it look like to think you have a natural tendency to be gay? So yeah, you have actually a lot of really good Columbo 1 questions, actually, you know, in terms of the way you're thinking. You see these things, you know intuitively they don't make sense, and you're asking a kind of a question of it. So the way I would say it perhaps would be, well, I was born with a natural tendency to lie when I get into trouble, you know. I have a natural tendency to lie to get myself out of trouble when I find myself stuck, you know. Certainly that can't be okay. So that's kind of a less crass example than, say, pedophilia, or I'm born with a natural tendency to punch homosexuals, you know, when I see them. It's like, I mean, you know, there's all kinds of ways to make it funny, but oftentimes that funny thing or that example might come across as mean-spirited. So you want to try to think of examples like, I have a tendency to want to, you know, neglect people who are elderly or something, you know, when they need help. It's like, well, that's terrible, you know. So you can always think of ways of thinking of examples that are less over the top. Okay. Good. How about another one? Yeah, if it was written by men, okay. That's right, yeah. So does that mean like you can't believe the DMV manual? You know, the dictionary, you know, just you can go through a number of books that were written by men that you would say, well, so you have to discount them just because they were written by men, you know. So, yeah, so again, the rationale is if it's written by humans, I can't trust it. You know, that leads to all kinds of ridiculous things, like you pointed out. Well, there's all kinds of books that are written by humans, so you can't trust those either. Good. What else? What's another one of these that we could take the roof off? You take the roof off with all of them. How about the next one? I can do whatever I want with my own body. Yeah, so that could be an example of taking the roof off. The only that would mean that, well, I can commit suicide, so that would make it okay. The only problem with that example is that they might think that suicide is permissible, you know. So, especially in Michigan, right, where you've had some famous physicians who have been advocates of physician-assisted suicide, for example. But there's other examples that you can use to take the roof off with that. What might be one? Okay, drinking too much. Robbing and stealing, it could be. That might be argued, though, that it's affecting another person, you know. I might say, well, if I can do whatever I want with my own body, can my eyes look to the left or to the right if there's another exam next to me that someone else is writing, you know? That doesn't technically hurt anybody else, but yet I'm cheating, nevertheless. I'm doing that with my own body. can I make jokes about bombs as I cross the TSA lines over at the airport? No, you can't. you can, but you'll be in big trouble. In fact, the instant you step into an airport, the government slaps all kinds of restrictions on what you can do and not do with your body, by the way. So there's all sorts of absurdities that result from this statement that you can do whatever you want with your own body. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater when there is no fire. You can't do a lot of things. Now, again, that might impinge upon other people's safety, like you were saying, a robbery. But still, those are examples of where you can't do whatever you want with your own body. Okay, what about, how about the next one? Morals are relative. What's right and wrong is up to each person. This is the de facto morality of the United States, of American universities, and for most of the church as well, by the way. Yes, I saw a hand come up, yes? Is anything a crime? Yeah, so you're saying, well, if whatever is right and wrong is up to each person, then how could you even define a crime as being wrong, right? Because if I say, well, you can't do that, that's a criminal act, they might say, well, that's just my morality. You don't have to think it's wrong. Okay, could you give maybe something more specific, though, perhaps? But yeah, that would be. That's right. Yeah.
So, I mean, so somebody decides to run a red light.
That's right. Yeah, you can't say, well, that's just my morality that it's okay to run red lights. You don't have to think it's wrong, but, I mean, you might think it's wrong, but I don't think it's wrong. Yeah, that would lead to chaos. It would lead to hurting other people. I remember I was watching a video of a priest who was debating a feminist on the topic of abortion, and they each had their own podium. And she was making the claim that not only was abortion morally permissible, but that the priest doesn't have the right to impose his idea of morality on others, right? And so she was basically saying morals are relative. You know, what's right and wrong is up to each person. So he gets up off the stage, or gets down off the stage, walks over to her podium, and her purse was resting on the floor. He picks it up, and he starts pulling things out. And she's like, what are you doing? Like, he's in the middle of the debate. She's like, what are you doing? He's like, well, I'm just going through your purse. She's like, you can't do that. He's like, well, that might be your morality, but don't force it on me. You know, I think it's okay, you know. And so he was taking the roof off and by doing something, which is always the most effective way. In fact, when people say this in an audience, I'll just walk up to them and I'll try to see if they have like a phone or a cell phone. I'll just grab their phone and take it away. And they're like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm taking your phone. They're like, you can't steal my phone. I'm like, well, that might be your morality, but don't impose it on me. I mean, to each his own, right? And that just shows the ridiculousness of such a statement that morals are relative. They're not relative. No. All right. Anybody want to do any others? Or should we move on to the next tactic? Or are you kind of curious about some of the... Okay, which one? Okay, I'm personally against abortion, but I don't think we should make... So this is what we call the modified pro-choice position. It's what typically politicians will adopt. You know, you hear like the John Kerry's or I don't know if Nancy Pelosi says this, but I think they're both Catholic, and they'll say, well, my personal faith conviction is that, you know, abortion's wrong, but I don't want to, you know, force that on other people and make it illegal, you know. And in fact, many Christians I've run into, even in churches, will tell me the same view. You know, I'm personally against abortion, but I don't think we should make it illegal. But this leads to an absurdity, and let me tell you how what I do to exhibit this. I say this. I ask a person, why are you personally against abortion? And 9.8 times out of 10, they say the same answer. I'm personally against abortion because it kills an innocent human being, kills a baby. And then I say to this, let me replay back to you what you just told me. You think abortion kills an innocent baby, but you don't think we should make it illegal to kill innocent babies? When you put it that way, it makes it sound worse. I'm like, I'm not trying to put, isn't that your view? If I misrepresented your view, you correct me. They say, oh, yeah, I guess that doesn't make any sense. Yeah, of course, it leads to an absurdity. You think abortion kills an innocent baby, human being, but you don't think it should be illegal to kill innocent baby human beings? I mean, that sounds absurd, if that's their view. And that's why that statement, put that way, you can take the roof off with it. It leads to an absurdity. Don't like abortion, don't have one. This is a common bumper sticker. I don't know if you guys have this bumper sticker, but the question I ask a person is this. Don't like slavery? Then don't own a slave. How's that? Now, the reason why that statement is ridiculous is because, or the statement about slavery is, we're not saying that slavery is not my preference. You know, I'm personally against slavery, but I think it's okay if you own a slave. No, who says that, right? That's ridiculous. The people who say that slavery is wrong think it's wrong for everyone. But that's what we're saying about abortion. We're not saying, I personally don't like abortion. I think it's wrong, but you can do it. No. And so the way I show that that's absurd is I make an example of slavery. You know? Would it make sense to say, I'm personally against slavery, but I think it's okay if you want to own a slave? And nobody would say that. Because we all know that slavery is wrong for everybody. And in the same way, we're saying, our claim at least, is that abortion is wrong for all people to kill innocent human beings. So basically what that bumper sticker is trying to do is trying to relativize abortion. It's trying to just make it sound like our view on abortion is like our view on our favorite flavor of ice cream. You know, I might like toasted coconut at Kilwin's, but somebody else might like salted caramel. And you just pick your own, you know. You know, don't like salted caramel? Don't order salted caramel. You know, but that's not what we're saying. You know, we're not picking our favorite choice of ice cream. We're picking, we're deciding upon a moral question, abortion or slavery. And so that's what I do. I just say, well, don't like slavery? Well, then don't own one. How's that for a bumper sticker? And they're like, oh, that sounds weird. Yeah, it sounds weird is because you can't relativize slavery just like you can't relativize abortion. All right, we'll do the last one since we hit them all here. Okay. This is the hardest one to get. But and by the way, it doesn't matter whether you're for capital punishment or against capital punishment. Even if you're for it, this statement is still mistaken. It leads to an absurdity. Does anybody know why? In other words, there might be reasons why capital punishment is wrong, but that's not one of them. What absurdity results? Well, yeah, you might. Yeah, you could say you don't know whether Jesus would forgive, but that's not. That's an absurd. That doesn't lead to an absurdity. What? No, 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 it's not. Yeah, exactly. So the rationale is this. We should not levy the punishment of capital punishment because Jesus would forgive the person. Okay, well, let's apply that to putting them life in prison. Well, this rationale would apply there. Well, we shouldn't levy the punishment of life in prison because Jesus would forgive that. Oh, okay, well, let's just put them for 15 years in prison and fine them $10,000. Oh, but Jesus would forgive. Okay, so we can't levy that punishment. So maybe just a slap on the wrist and, you know, one day in jail. Oh, but Jesus would forgive. Oh, okay, so basically we should empty all the prisons and never levy any punishment because after all, Jesus would forgive. Do you see the rationale? Leads to this absurdity. If you can't levy any punishment on a person because Jesus would forgive, well, then you can't levy any punishment. And that's the problem. Again, capital punishment might be wrong. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying that that's not the rationale that could justify why capital punishment is wrong. Because that rationale is absurd. All right, any questions about that tactic, taking the roof off? Again, anytime you hear a statement, the way to really practice this is see it in writing. Reading a news article or hearing it somewhere, write it down, or if it's written down, just you can analyze it. What's the rationale? Write down the rationale. And then see, does it lead to any absurd conclusions? As you do that in your mind and you practice it, you'll be able to recognize it in conversation much quicker. But it's hard in conversation because the conversation's happening, you're trying to follow along, and you don't pick it up. But if you read it in a magazine or an article or on the internet, it's a lot easier because you can stop, think, what's the rationale here? Morals are all relative. You can do whatever you want. Okay, well, wait a minute. That means I could punch someone. That would be okay. Wow, that's absurd. That's right. You know, so that's how you could see it. Any questions, comments about taking the roof off? Okay, let's do the suicide tactic. This is a tactic that takes advantage of the fact that many views or statements contradict themselves. And so we say they basically commit suicide. Okay? Meaning that the view or the statement itself has within it the seeds of its own destruction. And let me kind of give you some obvious examples of what I'm talking about to kind of get your mind thinking this way. What if I was to say to you, I cannot speak a word in English? This is a statement that commits suicide. It's self-contradictory. Because the instant I say that sentence, I've contradicted myself, right? I cannot speak a word in English, but I can speak a word in English. Do you see how those two statements are contradictory? Or how about this? I never, never repeat a word. Okay? As soon as I say that, I've repeated a word, but I just said I never do it. See, that's a contradictory kind of thing. Or there are no sentences longer than four words. But there's one, you know. So again, self-contradictory statements are basically breaking a rule of logic called the law of non-contradiction. Of course, if we were to call this class Logic 101, nobody would ever come to it. But so we call it tactics in defending the faith. But in reality, we're just simply learning basic rules of logic. And this is one of them, that two contradictory statements can't be true at the same time and in the same sense. Okay, I cannot speak English. I can't speak English. Those are two contradictory statements. And when I said I cannot speak a word in English, I, in essence, said those two statements, and they contradicted themselves. All right. Even Avicenna, the ancient Islamic philosopher, knew of this principle, and he said, anyone who denies the law of non-contradiction should be beaten and burned, until he admits that to be beaten is not the same as to not be beaten, and to be burned is not the same as to not be burned. So, in case you don't get that, don't worry about it. But basically, he's saying you can't have two contradictory statements at the same time that are both true. Okay, one is true, one is false. They can't both be true, right? And so, in reality, when somebody offers a statement that is self-contradictory, it's immediately false. Okay, a self-contradictory view or a statement that commits suicide is not weaker. It's utterly false, all right? So let me give you a couple of other sort of examples to kind of get you warmed up a little bit more. However, if I say this, my brother is an only child. Do you see the contradiction there? I'm saying my brother doesn't have any siblings, but by saying my brother, I'm implying siblings. So I have siblings, I have no siblings. Those two statements are contradictory. That's why that statement commits suicide. Okay, it's immediately false. Or how about this? Ask me about my vow of silence. Well, the minute I say it out loud, I've broken that vow, so I don't really have a vow. Okay, or sometimes maybe you get like your water bill or your utility bill or maybe your bank statement, and it's maybe multiple pages long. So you're flipping through your statement, and as you get to maybe the last page or you turn over a page, you see this written there. This page intentionally left blank. Well, not anymore. You know, as soon as they wrote in it, it's not blank. You know, it's like, this is a self-contradictory statement, you know, because they're saying it's blank, but it's not blank. Or, I used to believe in reincarnation, but that was in my former life. You know, so this is saying that I no longer believe in reincarnation, but I'm saying that that was something that happened in my former life, which presumes I had a former life, which presumes I do believe in reincarnation. So that was a little hard to get. Or I've had amnesia for as long as I can remember. You know, but again, these are self-contradictory statements. Now, many years ago, you see people who do things that are self-contradictory. And one time I was partnering with this pro-life organization based out of Wichita. We were on a college campus, and they had posted these huge 20-foot pictures of aborted babies, very graphic and bloody. And naturally, they had put them in the center of this campus, and they put these fences around it. And so, of course, hundreds of students had gathered to protest and get upset at this protest of abortion. So basically, my friends were protesting abortion, saying, you know, we're coming onto this campus, and we're protesting abortion. Then some other people came to protest our protest, and they had a sign that said POOP, and it stood for Protesters Opposed to On-Campus Protests. So they're opposed to people protesting on campus, but they're protesting on campus. So, I mean, they're doing the very thing that... You know. Anyways, you get what I'm getting at here. This is basically self-contradictory, saying one thing but doing something else that contradicts that. So here's how the suicide tactic looks. Three steps. First, identify the basic claim. Figure out what are they saying. It's just like step one of the taking the roof off. You just want to understand what's their view, what's the claim, what's being said. And then ask, does what they say or does their view contradict itself? And if it does, then ask a question that graciously uncovers how it contradicts itself. Okay, So let's take a look at an example. There is no truth. I remember my cousin in England, when I lived in England, my cousin used to say, "Oh, come on, Alan, there's no truth. You keep talking about Jesus is the truth. There's no truth," you know. Now, obviously, step one here is very easy. What's the basic claim? The basic claim is there's no truth. Nothing is true. Okay. Now we ask the second question. Does this statement contradict itself? What did you say? That's right. Yeah, this statement claims to be a true statement. But the statement says there is nothing true. So do you see how it contradicts itself? The person who's telling me this is saying there's nothing true, but they think that that statement they just made is true, that there's nothing true. And that's why this is a meaningless statement. They're basically saying my brother's an only child, but they think they're sounding intelligent. Or how about this? You shouldn't judge other people. This is actually a self-contradictory statement. This commits suicide. Does anybody know how? That's right. That's right. By them saying, "Alan, you shouldn't judge other people," they're basically saying, "You are wrong." And that's in itself a judgment. So they're actually judging me, telling me that I'm wrong to judge other people. They're doing the very thing they're claiming I shouldn't do. You know? So, by the way, the way I expose this, I just simply ask them, when somebody says to me, "You shouldn't judge other people," I say, "Well, why not?" Now, whatever answer they give will be an example of them judging me. "Well, Alan, because it's wrong to judge." "Well, then why are you judging me?" No matter how they answer this question, "Why not?" will be an example of them judging me. And that's why this is just self-contradictory. Okay, so let's... Any questions about self-contradictory statements before we break up again and try some of these? Okay, let's do that. So break up again into pairs of twos or threes. The bottom two are the hardest, so you can skip those if you want, or if you want to try them, that's fine. But try to figure out, all of these statements commit suicide. All of these statements undermine themselves. All of these statements are self-contradictory. Just try to figure out how they're self-contradictory, and then think of maybe a question you could ask that exposes that. Okay? And then we'll come back together after 5 minutes. So go ahead, break up into twos and threes, and try to figure out maybe one or two of them. You don't have to do all of them. Okay, so let's try to go through a couple of these. Anybody want to take a stab at one of them?
You shouldn't tell people they're wrong. And you're telling
Yeah, so if I understand you correctly, you're basically saying that the person who says this to you, you know, so let's say, and by the way, the context of this conversation was I was talking to my friend, she's an atheist, and she has a friend who's cheating on her husband, and I was commenting, I was saying, I can't believe they're doing that, it's so wrong. And she said to me, you shouldn't tell people they're wrong. And so basically, yeah, she's telling me I'm wrong for saying that someone else is wrong. So she's doing the very thing that she's telling me not to do, right? And again, the way you could expose that is by simply asking, why not? You know, they say, you shouldn't tell people they're wrong. Why not? Well, because it's wrong to do that. So you're saying I'm wrong, correct? Well, then you're telling me I'm wrong. I mean, you're doing the very thing that you're telling me not to do. Yeah, so that one's just like the previous one, which is you shouldn't judge other people. Okay, well, what's another one? Oh, well, actually, you know, let's just do the first one because this one's very similar. You shouldn't force your morality on others. Again, if somebody tells you that, what are they doing? That's right, they're forcing their morality because part of your morality is to tell other people and to try to force your morals on other people. I mean, you're not trying to force it, but you do want to convince other people of genuine morality, what's right and wrong. So, but they think it's wrong for you to do that, which is part of their morality. And they're trying to have you adopt it. So, again, they're doing the very thing that they're telling you not to do. Okay, so how about some of the other ones that are... Yeah, okay. So does anybody know, by the way, how that one is self-refuting? You can only know what is proven by science? Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So if the only thing that is true or that we can have knowledge of is that which is testable by the methods of science, then that statement itself is not something that you could test by science. You can't take that sentence and put it in a beaker or put it over a Bunsen burner or centrifuge it or, you know, get a, you know, electrophoresis gel or do whatever scientific. You can't. That's a philosophical claim. So that statement itself is not testable or provable by science. So therefore, we can't know that that statement is true. Well, if we can't know that that statement is true, then that statement is false. Okay. So again, there, you know, you're usually, it's probably, the context is you're in a conversation and you make a claim that we can know something, perhaps through historical inquiry, maybe about the resurrection or about Jesus. And they're trying to dismiss that and say, well, you can't know that. That's not, the only things that you can know are testable by science. Yeah, but your statement, sir, is not something that we can know by science. So you can't even have that sentence meet the requirements that you just set forth for how we can come to know knowledge. Okay? The truth is, we can come to know things. Yes, science can tell us information about the world, but so can historical investigation, so can testimony, so can introspection. We can gain knowledge about the world with many ways. Well, yeah, observing, sure, observation, yeah. But I mean, if you want to know how you feel right now, you can't figure that out with science. No scientific test you poke and prod in someone's brain can ever tell you how you feel right now. The way you can know how you feel is by introspecting. So introspection is actually a method of gaining knowledge about the world, particularly about your own feelings. Like right now I feel hungry, you know, or maybe I'm maybe I'm sad about my cat's passing or something, whatever, you know. You can't know that through science. You can only know that through introspection. If you want to know whether it's raining outside and you live, you know, you're in a some building or whatever, you can just simply ask someone who came from outside. Is it raining outside? And by virtue of testimony, they can tell you. By virtue of testimony, your parents can tell you what hospital you were born in or when you were born in, you know. By virtue of historical investigation, we can know about whether Abraham Lincoln lived, you know, or George Washington, or what they said or what they did. So there's many tools that can give us knowledge about the world. Science is one of them, but not the only one. Okay. Anyways, that was more than what we're talking about. But okay, how about this one? It's wrong to try to change other people's religious beliefs. When I was in physical therapy school, I was going to go on a short-term missions trip to Kazakhstan, and I remember kind of raising some funds from my classmates Of course, not all of them were Christian, but I thought, well, maybe some of them might, support me. And so when they said, well, why are you going to Kazakhstan? I said, well, we're going to be supporting an orphanage there and using that as an opportunity to present the gospel, you know. Now, most people there are either Muslim or atheists. And so my classmates were like, well, you should have tried to go to other countries and change other people's religious beliefs. Now, how does that statement commit suicide? Okay, and what does my belief entail? Yeah, so my belief entails going to other people and changing their religious beliefs. They're saying I shouldn't do that. But guess what they're trying to do? They're trying to change my religious beliefs. Because my religious beliefs entail doing that, and they want me to not do that. So again, they're contradicting themselves. They're self-refuting. They're undermining the very thing they're claiming. They're saying, don't go change other people's religious beliefs, but I'm going to try to change your religious beliefs. Well, that's a contradiction. Okay. Everyone's view is a product of their own prejudices, so they're not reliable. You know, a lot of people say, "Well, you know, you grew up this way and that way, and so your view is just a product of your upbringing and all the prejudices you carry." So we can't trust that view. What's that? Yeah, well, that's, I never thought about that. It's possible. I mean, they're making a claim it could be that they are prejudiced, but they're more making a claim that your view can be dismissed because it's based on prejudices. So how could this be self-contradictory? Their view is not relevant. Why not? Well, yeah, because that's right. They came to believe this sentence is true based on what? Their own prejudices. That's right. So if everyone's view is dismissible because it's the product of prejudices, well, then even their view is dismissible because it's also the product of prejudices. So we can reject that statement. Okay? Do you see what's going on here? These sentences might sound very intelligent, and I've heard PhDs stand up at a university audience in front of 5,000 people at my university in California and make statements like this. You know, no one can know the truth. No one has the total truth about everything. But now let me give you the reality of what truth is. And after they finish, there is a standing ovation and applause. And all the person got up and said is, my brother is an only child, and he was given a standing ovation for that. I mean, that's all they're saying. My brother's an only child. They're saying something that self-contradictory, and they're getting applauded for it. Because people don't recognize this. In fact, when that person and that PhD guy said this, he said, well, you know, no religion has the total truth. I've traveled the world, and no one religion or person has the total truth. Which, by the way, notice what he's doing. He's claiming he has the total truth about all of reality, all the while claiming that no one has it except for me. So I raised my hand, because they had a Q&A time, and the moderator was somebody I knew, so I knew in a sea of 5,000 people they'd ask me. I said, Professor, I forgot his name, I said, Dr. Whoever. I said, it seems to me that you're making the claim that no one has the total truth about reality, but you seem to be offering a total truth about reality. How is that not self-contradictory? Now keep in mind, if he was to admit that he was doing that, he just basically said, my brother's an only child and looks like a total fool. But of course, oh, well, I see where you're going, and he kind of walked his way out of that. There's no way he's going to admit that in front of 5,000 people. But that's in essence what he was saying, you know. So, again, these things sound so intelligent and sophisticated and tolerant and reasonable, but in reality, these people are saying, I cannot speak a word of English, and they're saying it in English. Yes?
What's a gracious question to ask that person that says,
I would just simply say, is that including your view? I don't think so. Let's think of a way to soften it. Well, you might maybe spell it out, but you could say, well, if everyone's view is a product of their own prejudices, wouldn't that also include your view? I mean, you could kind of ask it. Yeah. No. But basically they're saying the same thing. All right. What time are we taking a break for lunch?
Anytime you're ready.
Okay. Well, all right, we can stop here then. You want to do the last? Okay. You want to do the hard ones?
We have an hour and a half for lunch, so if people want to go a little long, we have plenty of time.
Okay. I'll just do these last two here then. God can't exist if evil exists. So, does anybody happen to know why this might be self-contradictory? Yes. Well, if God created everything, and he therefore would have created evil, well, then that's a problem for our view, because then that makes it look like God created evil. That doesn't show why this is self-contradictory. Yes, and why is that the case? You're right. You're switching up the sentence, but there's a rationale behind it. Here's the thing. People want to argue that because there's all this evil in the world, that this is evidence against God's existence. The problem is that the words good and evil make absolutely no sense in a world where God does not exist. Because here's the thing. The only way that you can have good and evil make sense and for us to recognize an action as good or evil, if there is a God who gives a standard, a perfect standard of morality, such that, you know, robbing a woman of her purse will be deemed as an immoral act. It's a departure from that perfect standard. Okay? If there is a God that has a perfect standard, we can say, well, this behavior is a departure from that standard. That's why we can identify it as evil. But if there is no God, there is no standard of morality, therefore how can we say that anything is evil? And so the reason why this is a self-contradictory statement is because it assumes that you can identify what evil is, but the only way to identify that something is evil is if there's a God that gives a standard of morality that tells it that this is evil. But if they're assuming that God exists in order to prove he doesn't exist, well, then that's a contradiction. Right? Again, how do you know whether a person's a good bowler or a bad bowler? Their score, right. What's a perfect score? 300. So if you bowl a 50, you know that because 300 is a perfect standard of a bowling game, that 50 is pretty bad and 288 is really, really good. Okay? But if there was no perfect score in bowling, like there was no 300, then if I bowled 50, could you say I did good or bad? No. You just say you bowled 50. That's neither good or bad. You just bowled a 50. That's why that 300 score is an objective standard by which we can judge all other scores. And in the same way, without God existing and having an objective standard, you couldn't judge every behavior as good or bad or evil. And so to argue that God doesn't exist if evil exists is a contradiction, because in order to even recognize anything as evil, you have to first assume God exists. In fact, philosophers say, they put it this way, they say, you have to sit in God's lap in order to slap him in the face. You have to sit in God's lap. You have to assume that God exists before you get slapped in the face and say, I don't believe you exist. But that's contradictory. Does that make sense? You have to have a standard of morality that can only come from God in order to identify something as evil. Well, then you can't turn around and take that identification of evil to argue that God doesn't exist. That's self-contradictory. All right, God doesn't take sides. Okay, This is definitely the hardest one. This was said in a political debate. I forgot, it was many years ago. It was a presidential debate. And I forgot if it was like George Bush and Al Gore or John Kerry. I can't remember, but it doesn't matter. The point is that there was this discussion about, is God on my side or on your side, kind of a question. And somebody said, well, God's on my side, or God's okay with my side. And the other person responded, well, God doesn't take sides. And everybody applauded. Woo, yes, that sounds like so, you know, PC intolerant. But in reality, that's a self-contradictory statement. And here's why. Again, if you don't get it, it's okay. It's hard to think this way. But on the question of whether God takes sides or does not take sides, That person was saying that God does not take sides, which in itself is a side. Okay? See, God, either he takes sides or God does not take sides, right? Those are the only two options. And this candidate was saying God does not take sides. But that is a side on the question of whether God takes sides or not. Anyways, it's hard. Don't worry about it. But all the point here is that so many statements that we hear in culture are said in intense scientific journals, great, you know, articles in Time or Newsweek or USA Today, whatever, are statements that sound so reasonable and true, but many times you can take the roof off, or they're self-contradictory. You know, they commit suicide. And we don't recognize it because we haven't been trained to think this way. But again, if we pause and try to outline, or not outline, but just write down, what is the claim being made? Does it lead to a contradiction, or does it lead to an absurdity? I guarantee you, if it's a false statement, it'll do one of the two, almost 99% of the time. Well, that's the point that the person was trying to make, but it's still contradictory, because by claiming that he's chosen a side, I mean, he's in essence saying, God has taken a side. It's this one. And the side is, he doesn't take sides. Well, you just said he has taken a side. Now, he didn't say that. He said, God doesn't take sides. But by saying that, he's pointing to one of the two options. Either God takes sides or he doesn't. And this guy's saying, this is true, as opposed to that. Okay? And that's why it's a contradiction. God doesn't take sides. Oh, but he hasn't picked that one. He's picked this one. That is a side. Yeah, Scott? Does God agree with the observation? Yeah, that's a great question. That would expose the self-contradictory. You know, he says, God doesn't take sides. Well, does God agree with you on that? Yeah, of course he does. Well, then he has taken a side. And that's a great question to use to expose that. So we're going to take a break, but let me just close out with this. Skip these here. Final thoughts here. In the Marine Corps, I live right by Camp Pendleton, which is the largest Marine Corps base in the United States. It might be in the world, in fact. But they say this, the more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in battle. And this is also the case with tactics. The more you practice these tactics beforehand or in friendly environments, or just to kind of, you know, diagram them out or whatever on a piece of paper before you engage them, the more you'll become familiar with it and the less you'll kind of bleed when you actually go out and do this with real people. And then don't be discouraged by outward appearances. A lot of times people might not come across as if being convinced by what you said, but the Holy Spirit oftentimes will use what you said later on, afterwards, to kind of work on their mind or their soul. In fact, many times I've had people come up to me weeks later and say, hey, you know what? I was thinking about what you said, and you know, at first I was really resistant to it, but I see what you're saying. I think you're right about, you know, whatever you said. So people's minds often change later on, and you don't necessarily see that. And then here's the other thing is, don't feel like any time a conversation comes up about either Jesus or about morality, that you have to go then all the way and present the gospel and get them to bend the knee. You know, sometimes it's okay to just finish off with the topic that you were speaking about and not feel like you have to go all the way to the gospel, you know, hit a home run. Now, I'm not saying don't do that if the opportunity arises. By all means, present the gospel. I'm just saying don't force it into every conversation just because you're talking about the Bible or morality, you know. If somebody says, well, you know, this is the Bible of all, you know, science books or whatever, you know, they make a reference to the Bible, you're like, oh, they said the word Bible. How can I bring in the gospel? It's like they're just using that as a metaphor or figure of speech. Don't get too excited. Just take it easy, you know, because if you force the gospel into every conversation, people will get annoyed by that. And then make it your goal to put a stone in their shoe, you know. If you ever, like, been walking around, you get a pebble in your shoe, and every time you step, you're kind of reminded by that thing. Well, that's kind of what we want to do as ambassadors for Christ. We want to leave them with something to think about, so as they walk away from that conversation, they're constantly bugged by this thing in their mind that'll hopefully the Holy Spirit can use to convict them of their ideas. And I really like what Mother Teresa says here. She said, God has not called me to be successful. He's called me to be faithful. And I think this really expresses kind of the heart of what it means to be an ambassador, and that is, look, don't feel committed to the end result. We are not, our job is not to convince people or to change their minds or make them Christians. Our job as ambassadors is simply to present the truth in a compelling, persuasive, and gracious way. And then we allow God to deal with the results, to convict them of sin, to cause them to repentance, to bring them to faith in Christ, to change their minds, okay? You be committed to your part, which is presenting the gospel, presenting the truth, presenting whatever you're communicating in a knowledgeable, tactically wise, and winsome way, all right? Be committed to that part, your part as an ambassador, and leave the results up to God, all right? So we are in for lunch, and then we're going to come back, and we'll shift gears and talk about what I believe is the most important skill that every Christian needs to have, literally the most important skill that I believe actually is foundational to everything else you do as a believer. So that's what we'll be talking about after lunch.